For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast. This podcast is recorded and produced on the lands of the Djabal and Djerriwarr peoples. I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, their elders past, present and emerging. Dr. Lachlan McIver is an Australian rural generalist who currently works as the Tropical Diseases and Planetary Health Advisor for Médecins Sans Frontières, based in Geneva. In between those two roles has been a medical career packed with rural and remote experience in emergency rooms from Broome and Alice Springs to the Pacific Islands and Africa. Along with colleagues, Lockie founded Rocketship, an international non-profit which is dedicated to improving health in Pacific Island nations by running postgraduate primary care training. Overarching all of this is Dr. McIver's passion for climate change activism, most obviously through his current role with MSF, but it's a cause he's been fighting for all his life. Lockie has written a book called Life and Death Decisions, which details his medical career so far, including his love of rural generalism, his fight for justice for island nations and others impacted by climate change, and his own personal battle with depression. I'm delighted to have Lockie McIver as my special guest today. Cracking read. What made you decide to write it?
I should really have a potted answer prepared for this question. It was a series of a few steps, Kate, as you can imagine. I've always been literary minded, let's say.
Yep.
Always enjoyed reading, enjoyed dabbling in writing, but things got a bit more serious around 10 years ago when I was getting into the thicket of my PhD. And I realized that I actually quite enjoyed the writing process, which sounds a bit masochistic, right? But you know, again, obviously felt a bit hemmed in by the restrictive nature of the genre. Pretty limited opportunities for the kind of, you know, Baroque language to which I'm occasionally inclined in the confines of a distinguished medical journal, as you well
exactly
know.
Exactly right. Exactly.
So when I eventually emerged from the forest of the thesis, I had this inkling that I would like to be able to express myself a little bit more creatively. But perhaps even more compelling was the fact that what I had been writing about in my PhD, i.e. health impacts of climate change in Pacific Island countries, I felt was an extremely important topic that was far too small an audience in terms of, you know, people who would read the PhD and read the thesis and actually have the opportunity to learn about these issues. So those factors combined, I guess, catalyzed this idea in my mind that maybe I should at some point write about that kind of topic in a more kind of engaging and accessible way. That idea was sort of, you know, marinating in the back of my mind for a while. And then once I had been through a very, very dark and stormy period in my life with the depression and whatnot and was emerging from that, I found mm-hmm. that writing, particularly poetry, you know, in a mud hut, in a war zone, in a swamp, kind of triggered this next phase. I was like, okay, now's the time. I had a tiny bit of free time because, you know, eventually I left the role that I had at MSF and sort of in the gig economy and managing my own jobs and calendar and whatnot. So I quarantined some time on a regular basis. Said it's go time, and it just took the shape of a memoir, but obviously with the intention to use that as a vehicle to deliver some rather more weighty messages. The book was largely written in between my two roles with MSF. So I was previously the medical advisor for infectious diseases, epidemics, and antimicrobial resistance for a department within MSF International Office called the Access Campaign. I left that role in 2019, and it was in that interim period of around 18 months that I just blasted through the initial draft of the manuscript. And particularly there was sort of pedal to the metal period from sort of mid-late 2020 when this new opportunity came along as the Tropical Diseases and Planetary Health Advisor at MSF mm-hmm. Operational Centre Geneva. I was like, oh, okay, got to crack on and finish this thing because I imagine that gig's going to be pretty busy.
And has it been?
It has been, yeah. Very rewarding and interesting, but I definitely needed to wrap the book up both in terms of the writing but also in terms of the timeline. I don't want to create too many spoiler alerts for anyone listening who may yet to read the book, but that's kind of when things wrap up in the book is when I embark on this new chapter.
Yeah. I mean, I loved your writing style.
Thank you.
You started in heartbreaking fashion with the story about your dad dying so suddenly when you were, 16, yeah? And the other thing that really got me was You were talking about your early years in emergency in Perth and the story of Susie and the one line you said, loneliness is a poison. That just got me no end. How many Susies do you come across in that line of work? Because it was very confronting, wasn't it?
I'm really touched that you like that line, Kate, because I also really like that line, as tragic as it is. But it's true,
for
right?
Everybody. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why I really wanted to drop it in there, because I think, you know, we live in an era, and, you know, I don't want to get too kind of philosophical about the social ills of social media and isolation and all the rest of it, but the power of connectedness and community as positive determinants of health, I think, can't be understated. And conversely, if people are alone or feel alone or are neglected, feel neglected, then, you know, it shouldn't be surprising that they end up in our emergency departments in extremis.
For the listeners who haven't read the book, Susie was in extremis and in a terrible way. But that loneliness is a poison line applies to every single person on the planet, whether they're in extremis or not. And it takes a long time for us to learn that lesson sometimes, doesn't it?
One of the strange aspects of that phenomenon is that it's not always obvious, right? You can be literally surrounded by people and still feel very lonely. And so, you know, this gets us into the mental health side of things and what it means to, you know, to suffer from depression or anxiety or you know, these kind of mood disorders or sort of social and behavioural challenges. So it's not just sort of being, you know, stuck in a house on your own, like as a shut-in for years, that means you're lonely. There's a lot of different forms of loneliness.
Did your depression sneak up on you? Did it take you by surprise when it really hit full whack? Have you always known that you might have leaned that way?
Well, in answer to the latter question, definitely not. And, you know, I, in retrospect, cannot believe how naive I was. I recall saying to people as I sort of observed little hints of depression to other members of my family, oh, I think I'm kind of immune. I mean, what a recklessly disingenuous perspective to have. Apropos of that, it snuck up on me. It did. And look, I would have thought that someone who's you know, supposed to be reasonably intelligent and aware, that I would have been able to see that these things that were very clearly building up in my life in terms of professional pressures and social isolation and financial concerns and, you know, relationship problems, that really should have seen it coming, right? But it wasn't until I kind of, you know, collapsed in a quivering heap that I was like, oh, okay, well, that's what that was, or this is what this is. So it was subtle until it very much wasn't.
You talk about the use of psychedelics for treatment or part of your therapy. As it happens, we're writing a story this week, running on Monday, about psychedelics and how that field has really moved along, particularly in the last 5 years. Was it a revelation for you? Have you followed through with that in terms of looking into it further?
So yes, it was a revelation for me. And of course, I want to, you know, preface any further comments on my side by saying this was a very individual decision that I did, you know, with the appropriate support from my own treating health professionals, but without their direct involvement, right? This was something that I sought out on my own. And it's not a recommendation that I'm making to other people. I had certainly been noting with growing interest, this renaissance in interest and the very rapidly growing evidence basis of the potential therapeutic benefit of psychedelics in treating a variety of psychological and psychiatric disorders. And yes, I personally found the experience to be nothing short of revelatory, revolutionary, and you know, quite frankly, life-saving. So again, it's not a recommendation, but I have definitely had first-hand experience of you know, the power of these medicines, and it is astonishing.
Is it something you still do regularly, or is it you save it for crises?
No, well, look, it's not something that I think most people would do regularly, and certainly that's not been the case for me. The few occasions when I have sought out, been connected to those experiences have obviously been when I'm, you know, not involved in you know, clinical care of patients, right? I've been on leave and autonomous. They're certainly not known to be or thought to be addictive in any way, right? So you get connected to these experiences through desire and intention and circumstance. It's not something that I think I would ever do regularly, but I do suspect that if I felt the symptoms of depression kind of creeping up on me again, and I was not able to get on top of them by, you know, doing the usual things, you know, the sleep and diet and exercise and the non-pharmacological measures, then I would certainly consider that a very, very potent ace up the sleeve for sure.
Let's talk about climate change, because that's a huge passion for you. You've been passionate about it for a long time, and it's taken you a lot of places. I can't imagine for a moment that you're happy with the progress that's been made. How close to like complete and utter disaster are we in terms of particularly the Pacific Islands, because you know them exceptionally well? Have we made any progress at all?
Look, I think the short answer is no, not really. And how close are we? Well, I mean, we're talking decades, not centuries, to disaster o'clock, unfortunately. And you would think, again, as an ostensibly pretty intelligent and connected species, that we would have the means and the desire to save ourselves from ourselves.
Yeah.
But that is not translating into the kind of urgent and effective political decisions and policy actions that are required, that are absolutely essential to slow, halt, and reverse the effects of climate change. What keeps me awake at night, Kate, is this blindness or deafness that we as a society seem to have to these effects. There's this myth that I think a lot of people are, you know, laboring under the misapprehension of, that climate change is this sort of distant, long-term future threat, is something that is going to be mostly an issue for farmers or poor people or developing countries or you know, low-lying islands. That's garbage. You know, we really need to disillusion ourselves of this notion. This is a fairly obvious, immediate existential threat to, say, Pacific Island communities, but it is an issue that is affecting all of us. It is getting worse. It's getting worse quicker, more quickly than we had ever anticipated, and shows no signs of slowing anytime soon. So, I mean, if you forgive me for, you know, coming across as a bit apocalyptic, like, definitely have this feeling of, you know, why doesn't everyone understand?
So how does that translate into your day-to-day job? How does that frustration, how do you deal with that frustration? How do you keep going trying to convince people without hitting them?
Non-violent type, generally speaking. But I guess in a way you could make a parallel between the detachment that you know, one needs to have when dealing with issues like climate change from a professional perspective, and the detachment that one needs to have with dealing with serious illness or injury on a daily perspective, right? So as doctors, at some level, we need to kind of shield ourselves, compartmentalize the sort of reflected stress, trauma, emotion, whatever you want to call it, of the difficulty, challenge, catastrophe of the patient in front of us, right? Because if we, again, I kind of allude to this in the book in my junior doctor years of having to kind of figure this out, as I assume most of us do. Yep. If we absorbed the emotion of every person that's suffering in front of us, we'd be completely paralyzed. You know, apply that to this sort of, you know, public health, environmental health, global health challenge of climate change and health. You know, if I just spent my day kind of ranting and raving, even if it was only inside my own mind about how important this issue was and how terribly we were doing in addressing it, then again, I'd never get out of bed. Yep. So, the role I have currently at MSF Operational Centre Geneva as Tropical Diseases and Planetary Health Advisor is for me, it's a beautifully unique and rewarding mix of the clinical aspects of tropical infectious diseases. You know, everything from the sort of the biggies like malaria to rather more niche ones, some of the neglected tropical diseases like schistosomiasis, for example. Yep. Debating the finer points of field diagnosis of schistosomiasis in my last meeting.
Yeah.
So there's that kind of clinical angle. And then there's this much more macro perspective of, okay, what does climate change, for example, but also other forms of environmental degradation, deforestation, air pollution, heavy metal toxicology, heat and all the rest of it, what does that mean for MSF operationally? What does it mean for the patients and populations where we work in terms of the health problems that they are likely to experience because of these phenomena? And what does it mean for us in terms of how we need to be better informed and prepared and effective in our, you know, medical operational response? So I guess there's the intellectual satisfaction of thinking about this and trying to you know, do useful things in that field on a day-to-day basis that, you know, kind of helps helps my brain from imploding at the scale of the challenge.
I'm chatting with Dr. Lachie McIver, the Tropical Diseases and Planetary Health Advisor for MedSans Sans Frontières and a rural generalist. Lachie's book, Life and Death Decisions, is now available from all good bookstores and is published by Ultimo Press for Hardy Grant Publishing. If you are interested in working as a rural generalist in unique settings, you can get in touch with Rocketship at rocket-ship.org. Lachie also works for the Western New South Wales Local Health District's telehealth service. The full link is in the show notes to this podcast. If you're enjoying this episode, you can subscribe to our feed via your favourite podcast platform. Just search for Medical Journal of Australia and hit the magic button. Our back catalogue of episodes is available at mja.com.au/podcasts, where they are all free to access. Back to our chat. There's some weird things happening right now.
Yeah.
Understatement. There's COVID, which, you know, but there's, you know, there's monkeypox. We've got polio popping its head up in New York and London.
Yeah.
We've got this new zoonotic popping up in China, the like Langya virus or whatever. Do you sit there and you go, well, yeah, climate change?
That I definitely do sit there and go, yeah, of course. So as you've already pointed out, these phenomena, particularly these, you know, zoonotic virus spillover events, they're not just due to climate change, but it is a big factor. And the climate change and the population growth and the deforestation and the urban densification and desertification and all these kind of factors converge to increase this intensity of interaction between humans, animals, and the environment that is certainly unprecedented in human history. And so, you know, it is absolutely, or it should be, no surprise that we are seeing these spillover events occur. And, you know, sorry to say, I'm, you know, not the first, won't be the last to say it, the SARS-CoV-2 pandemic, you know, COVID-19 catastrophe, while it was not necessarily foreseeable in terms of the precise pathogen, the likelihood of a pandemic being caused by a virus jumping from animals to humans, that was pretty much always going to be the way it turned out and will likely be so for future pandemics, as it has been throughout most human history. So the fact that we're in a pandemic is no surprise. I think one of the key challenges we have before us is, again, I'm sure many of your listeners and peers and guests would be also thinking and commenting on, is how can we be better prepared next time around? What have we learned from this experience?
You're a North Queensland boy, a country boy.
Born and bred.
You've loved rural practice for as long as you've been practicing. You've done the Kimberley, you've done Alice Springs, you've done the Pacific Islands, you've done Africa. I know it's really hard to synthesize into a few sentences what it is about rural practice that just lights your fuse.
It really is the let me put in the frame of an anecdote. It's not in the book, so you're getting fresh material here. I think it was my last year of uni, and I'd gone back to North Queensland to visit my family, and I was driving out west to see my aunt and uncle and cousins who lived on a farm out in a hot springs. And as I was cruising along in the car, I came across a car crash. So it was like upturned vehicle on the side of the road. I think it might have been still slowly smoldering. And so I very slowly and reluctantly pulled over, looking around, seeing there's no one else here. And as a final year med student, you know, with due respect to final year med students, I didn't feel at the time that I was of any use to anyone in a medical sense. So I was like, bloody hell, am I really the first on the scene here? And if so, what am I going to do? And so I very nervously approached this wreck and was extremely relieved to find there was no one in there. So it obviously, being evacuated or whatever. But as I got back in my car and drove along again, slowly pondering what I had just seen, I had this probably for the first time in my medical training to date, this kind of crystallization of this notion that what I want to be is the kind of doctor that could deal with anything up to a point. So this is not to overstate the scope and skills of rural generalists. But what I realized in that moment, and obviously that had come on the heels of, you know, many rural placements and seeing rural doctors in action and having had several inspiring experiences over my med student years, but nothing that I sort of went, oh, that's exactly what I want to do. This was the first time I really had this sort of fully formed notion that I want to be able to deal with that kind of thing, but also whatever kind of thing, not as an expert in it, you know, like, you know, one would presume that an emergency physician or a surgeon, guys like this would be pretty useful coming across a car crash with people actually injured inside. But still, I'd seen enough rural doctors in action up to that point. And then I guess in this moment, I was like, well, what would I want to be as a doctor in that scenario? And I was like, you know, a rural generalist, even though I didn't know the term at the time, that was the sort of the forming of that idea.
There is a shortage here of doctors wanting to practice rurally, plugging the hole with international graduates, and they're fantastic and that's great, but it's not sustainable probably. How do we persuade medical students that going bush and being that jack of all trades is a really great idea? Mm. How do we convince them?
Well, I've written a book about it, trying to tickle really people's good. Interests.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, without being too kind of glib about it, I really did write that book very much with my colleagues in mind, right? I'm not trying to toot my own horn with this thing. It's like there's nothing special about what I do. My rural journalist colleagues are out there fighting a good fight every day in their rural communities and doing fantastic work. And it is my sincere hope that when those folks read that book, if they read the book, they will see themselves in it. In terms of your question about what can we do from a structural or systems policy perspective, I think it's important to acknowledge that a lot of progress has been made, right? So the establishment and evolution of the Australian College of Rural and Remote Medicine, for example, has been absolutely key in this whole process. And, you know, full disclosure, I've been on the board of ACRM a couple of times. I'm a part-time employee of the college, so just going to get that up front. But also, you know, credit where credit's due to the state government, health ministries in terms of establishing rural generalist training pathways and professional development programs, you know, post-fellowship to support them. Yeah. So, you know, the landscape has evolved and changed significantly for the better over the last couple of decades. But still, as you say, we are still seeing dramatic shortfalls in terms of rural generalist workforce distribution across the country. And despite the impressive efforts being made, for example, in got to give a shout out to Queensland, who has really led the way in many respects, there's still a lot more that needs to be done. Remuneration is a key factor, but it's not the only factor. You know, I make pretty clear in the book that there's plenty of places around Australia and around the world where, you know, most doctors are not going to go and stay no matter how much you pay them. But remuneration is key because you've got to make it worth their while. And it is also really important to acknowledge that the specialty of general practice, which is currently, you know, where rural generalist sits, is the least well remunerated of any specialty. This is a well recognized phenomenon. Yep. So I think having a bit more equity and parity is not only justified, it's overdue. And so the remuneration is key, but also the support, the systems issues are key as well. Very few people, no matter how adventurous you might be as a rural generalist, want to go out to a community, and no matter how much you love it, just get flogged nonstop, right? So there needs to be enough of us. We need to be supported from a management and governance and systems and resourcing perspective. We need to have a sufficient and well-trained and compatible nursing workforce. So, shout out to Krana and the Rural Generalist Nursing Movement. They're doing great work as well. Same with, you know, Indigenous health workers and allied health. All this comes together, right? It's not just about the bloody doctors. But, we need to see these different parts of the health system as an ecosystem and make sure that that is cultivated as a system to enable it to flourish.
Talk to me about Rocket Ship. Is it still going?
Yeah, it's going gangbusters. Chair of the board has just been at the Pacific Island Health Ministers meeting in Fiji, went via Vanuatu, renew our memorandum of understanding with the Ministry of Health there. So, I'm extremely pleased and proud to be sitting here chatting to you today and be able to say that Rocket Ship is going gangbusters. I think we proved throughout the pandemic that our mission and vision of supporting primary care physicians, rural doctors in the Pacific, is of paramount importance. I think because of the pandemic, that primary care is critically important. And if we have weak primary care systems, then the system just crumbles. So prioritizing postgraduate medical training for primary care clinicians in the Pacific is an appropriate and essential raison d'etre. And the model that we have of supporting the postgraduate training of particularly our colleagues in Tonga, So the first cohorts of Tongan doctors to be trained in the Master of Family Medicine program in Fiji, which we helped co-design and establish with Fiji National University. That has proved relatively pandemic proof. That family medicine program was the only postgraduate medical specialty training program run out of Fiji, which is the main regional training provider of the Pacific, to survive the pandemic without being suspended. And that is because of this, you know, remotely delivered and remotely supported model of training and professional development, and the not only the hard work and commitment of our rocket ship trainer team doing their best to support the registrars through whatever means possible, you know, webinars and WhatsApps and emails and online ALS courses and all the rest of it, but also the commitment of the doctors on the ground. So they are also dealing with the pandemic. They're also providing day-to-day care to their communities in the you know, rural areas, outer islands and all the rest of it, and still having this commitment to be training up as the kingdom's first family medicine physician.
That's amazing. So
credit all round. And yeah, we're really looking forward now from a rocket ship perspective to, you know, a new opportunity, a new set of opportunities to basically expand to meet the demand that we have.
Beyond the Pacific, or still in the Pacific?
Well, plenty of scope still to expand within the Pacific, I would say. I mean, some of us, Brett, myself included, might in our quieter moments, think slightly more grandiosely about our potential scope. But Pacific is where it's at the moment, and there's lots more that could be done. So, yeah, whether it's in Vanuatu with this renewed MOU, whether it's in Solomon Islands, where we've got we have had and still have a key role in establishing their first postgraduate rural medical training program. There's lots of scale up that is possible in the Pacific. Rocket Ship has been around long enough and has sort of got enough credibility banked and name recognition and connection that I think it's fair to say we're probably one of, if not the go-to organization for postgraduate medical training support for rural medicine, family medicine, community medicine in the Pacific. And it's just a matter of, us being able to secure the resources to enable that scale up to occur. So again, if you forgive me a moment, indulge me a moment, you know, anyone who's listening who's keen to support primary healthcare system strengthening the Pacific, please check out Rocket Ship and don't hesitate to support us in whatever way you can.
Have you got a second book planned?
Probably sequel. Should be talking to my agents and editors about this before I give you the scoop.
Okay? No worries.
Short answer is yeah. Got some ideas about that. So stay tuned.
Excellent. You still keeping up your clinical work?
Yeah, I am. I'm definitely keen not to hang up the stethoscope just yet. I've seen a lot of my colleagues, you know, go through that pretty significant dilemma. Huh? I mean, we devote so many years to training, and then we've worked for so many years as clinicians. You know, I look around, see, you know, particularly my senior colleagues in WHO and MSF, and there's often this sort of wistful look in their eye when I'm going to them and say, hey, can I have a few more weeks clinical leave? And they're like, yeah, you can, off you go. So, yeah, I'm still in the game. Now, that is, you know, particularly in light of the pandemic, that is largely thanks to the Virtual Rural Generalist Service in Western New South Wales. So shout out to them, to New South Wales Health for supporting this, and for Western New South Wales Local Health District for having the guts to get this up and going. Yeah, this, I was one of the first to join that service, and we went from being this like interesting, innovative little niche service that was a bit of an upstart beginning of 2020 to 3 months later being like the central to the whole district and state's health system response to the pandemic. So with the technology, of course, with the political commitment and with the, you know, the clinical courage involved in those that set it up and join the service, I think we've demonstrated really what's possible if you're willing to push the boundaries of telemedicine in the 21st century, in 2022. Obviously, a virtual doctor doesn't replace a real one, but it's a damn sight better than no doctor at all.
Exactly right.
And I generally, you know, you have good shifts and bad shifts, but I generally love my hours spent being beamed into you know, rural hospital emergency departments and inpatient wards, fantastic, and residential aged care facilities all around Western New South Wales for a night or two a week. It keeps me in the game, and of course, with that comes a requirement to spend a proportion of our shifts on the ground in the district, which I'm happy to do. So yeah, looking forward to getting back to Australia in September for the first time since the pandemic and getting my clinical kicks.
Lockie, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a hoot. Thanks heaps, Kate.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.